The last 3 months for Janelle and me have been one of those stretches where everything in our lives seemed to be constantly in motion. Sometimes it was trying to catch your breath, and we thought we had put in a few days off in the middle of teaching at FI and the conference, and then my wife's brother's ill health and complications from a stroke necessitated a trip to visit him in northwest Arkansas from Texas, where we were, which was about a 710-mile round trip. But because of just the exigencies of the situation and his own struggling to cope with these things, we ended up having 30 minutes with him after a 710-mile round trip. So that was a challenge. But it certainly seemed like everything was moving. That's what we felt or experienced or found ourselves focusing on. I'm sure every one of you has had times like that, which in comparison to other stretches of time in your life appeared to be just different. I'm not trying to one-up any of your experiences by any means. I'm sure we all have those things and those times, and we have to compare it to what our patterns and schedules and living life is usually like. Sometimes we end up saying to each other, welcome to my world, but that's not really the issue. Paul talked about not comparing ourselves with each other, and so I certainly don't mean to do that. I'm speaking of what David called in the Psalms a wide space. And sometimes you feel like you just missed a wide space for a while. I think we can all relate to that. When the space is constricted and felt different, and you longed for a break in the action of some sort. Will somebody stop this train so I can get off? I think we've all been there. So if you're with me, you know what I'm talking about. Some of the events that we experienced were certainly joyful ones. Like our reaching the milestone of 50 years of marriage. And the joy we had in sharing it with all of our children and our grandchildren and so many of our spiritual family members too. The absolute love and generosity that so moved us both from you and from so many others and kind of took our breath away and certainly surprised us, and we thank you for it from the bottom of our hearts. And inevitably, the pace does change eventually. It reminded me of something I used to hear many years ago, back when I looked like some of those pictures that some of you who were with us last Sunday saw in the 50-year montage of events in our wedding album photos. I saw people standing there looking at the wedding album photos with disbelief written on their faces. Who is that young guy with those funny-looking glasses and this mop of curly brown hair? I have no idea. I haven't seen him for years. My wife goes around saying the same thing all the time. I haven't seen him. No, she doesn't. But I used to hear a certain white-haired gentleman who'd been in the ministry quite a while by the time I heard him preach. And he used to say, it's like being a photographer. It's all in where you put the camera. It's all in your point of view. He was right. Some call it by different names, point of view, where you're coming from, where your focus is, frame of reference. Those are all phrases that describe pretty much the same thing. And right now, where we are is we shift gears in our continuing observance of God's special times, moving now from remembrances of past events with the allowance that Pentecost, just observed not so long ago, also reminds us of who we are, but it's also a past event, the giving of God's Spirit to the church as a whole in the year AD 31. You know, it's not that many years from now when we'll be talking about 2,000 years ago. You know, we're within reach of that. 8 years from now, as we keep the Feast of Pentecost in 2031, we'll be saying just 2,000 years ago on this day. Shockingly. But we move past events now, and we move the camera. We change it to a different spot, different point of view, to looking ahead, literally and prophetically, to future events. All the fall holy days. All four festivals in the fall are future events. They haven't yet happened. So we've never experienced them yet. We have faith that they will happen. We're looking forward for them to happen. And we have some questions to ask. I'm sure we all do. Where do we put the camera? What's our point of view? Where are we coming from to get to that place? Where are we headed? What's our frame of reference? And I think, brethren, at this time of the year, we find ourselves in another gap between holy day seasons. And I guess you could say, and it's a fair comment, that we're always in a gap between holy day seasons. Just depends on when it is. Now we're in a gap between the second season of the Feast of Weeks, Pentecost, and the fall holy days, third season of the year. It's worth thinking about moving from past to future. Trying to get a hold of it. Trying to understand what it means. Trying to focus on where things are going. We're told to watch what's going on around us. We're not taking part in it. We are representatives of God's coming government. We want to be and plan to be in His family, the reigning family, the government, the kingdom of God. We know the scripture says flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom. We get that. And we know that we'll be shifting our focus completely. But let's think about it by way of four examples from the Word of God. All of which, as I look at them, seem much more dire to me than any of my own trials or experiences so far. Every one of these situations we're going to look at, I shake my head and wonder and say, how in the world did they deal with that? Keep thinking as we look at these, what's my focus? Where's my focus? What's my frame of reference? And turn to Genesis 37, if you would. Genesis 37. It's the story of Joseph, and I think we're well familiar with it. This is early in the experience. In fact, we find from verse 2 of this chapter that he was 17 years old. 17 years old. I remember, well, I don't know that I do, but I'm told that I was once 17 years old. In a way, I sort of am now if I'm dyslexic, you know. Switch the numbers. 17. In chapter 37, he's looking for his brothers. Verse 15, a certain man found him, and there he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, "What are you seeking?" So he said, "I'm seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they're feeding their flocks." His father had sent him. They seemed to have been gone for some time with no word sent back. And the man said, "They've departed from here, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan or Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers, and he found them there in Dothan. Now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. And then they said to one another, "Look, this dreamer is coming. Come therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit. And we will say," meaning to their father, Jacob or Israel, "some wild beast has devoured him. We'll see what will become of his dreams." It's hard to understand that. The resentment that was built up from a wrong and improper and an unwise show of favoritism. But Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, "Let us not kill him." That's an interesting point in Reuben's favor, saying, no, we're not going to go that way. And Reuben said, "Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit which is in the wilderness, and don't lay a hand on him." And here was his purpose, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to their father, or to his father. Good intent. So it came to pass, when Joseph had come to his brothers, that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. Then they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it. So they sat down to eat a meal, and I'm sure he could hear them, the sound of their conversation. Put yourself in his shoes. Then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels. So these were related distantly. Ishmael, of course, was the brother, a half-brother of, you know, Isaac. So there's a relationship there. Coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So they were traders. So Joseph, or Judah, said to his brothers, "What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood?" Now that's not exactly a mark in Judah's favor. "Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites." So at least he didn't want to see him dead, but he had no idea, no way of knowing what kind of future he was setting up for his brother. "He is our brother and our flesh." And his brothers listened. And then it said, Midianite traders passed by. The brothers pulled him up, lifted him out of the pit, sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. We'll stop there for a minute. What was going through his mind as he was in that pit? What could he see? Well, the sky from the pit, that's about all. What could he focus on? What could he hear? Again, all you can literally see from the bottom of a pit would be the sky, but he could probably hear his brothers. You can hear the voices of the brothers. Maybe they were arguing, because it doesn't seem like there was a unanimity of purpose. We find out from later on that Reuben apparently wasn't there at the moment when the traders came by, because when he returned, he was very upset with his brothers. What are they arguing about? Joseph must have wondered. Are they going to leave me here to die? Will they kill me themselves? He heard some of the talk, I would guess. Keep that in your mind and turn to the book of Job. Let's look at our second example. Job chapter 1. You know the backstory, that God allowed Satan to come before his presence when the angels were in front before God and perhaps receiving guidance and instruction on what tasks and duties he had for them. And there's that conversation with Satan to God, and Job's name comes up. God raised it. Raised the name. He said, "Have you considered my servant Job?" And of course, Satan tells God, "Well, of course he worships you. Look at what you've done for him. Pull it all away and see where he stands then." Now, again, God's perspective is a little different from ours. So verse 13, we drop down. "Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And a messenger came to Job and said, 'The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them when the Sabaeans raided and took them away. Indeed, they have killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. You are financially ruined.' While he was still speaking, another came and said, 'The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and destroyed them or consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you.' While he was still speaking, another came and said, 'The Chaldeans formed three bands, raided the camels, and took them away. Yes, they killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Just boom, boom, boom. The source of his wealth is gone. While he was still speaking, another came and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And suddenly a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they're dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you." Then Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and he worshiped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Stop here for a minute. Before Job spoke those words, what was he thinking about? What could he see? What could he feel? What could he focus on? It goes a little further, chapter 2. And following this, because it had said in verse 22 of chapter 1, "In all this Job did not sin, nor did he charge God with wrong." And again, once again, Satan goes before God, and God says, "You know, you have moved me against him without cause." These are his words to Satan. Satan says, "Skin for skin, all that a man has, he'll give for his life. You stretch out your hand and touch his bone and flesh, he'll curse you to your face." So verse 7, Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck him with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took for himself a potsherd with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of the ashes. The ashes would have at least been soft. I don't know what else you could find to sit on. Stop here for a moment. What was he thinking about? What could he see? What could he feel? What could he focus on? He's sitting on a pile of ashes, soft enough to cushion the terrible pain from head to foot boils. I never had a boil, or carbuncle, which is a related thing. My brother had one once when I was very young, I remember. And I remember, you know, the nurse came to the house and lanced it to get the poison out of it, and it wasn't much fun. I was ready to head for the hills just to get away from what he was going through. We were pretty close when we were young, and we could get after each other sometimes, but when one of us was in trouble, you know how it is, blood's thicker than water. What was happening in his mind? Wondering, I'm sure, why is all this happening? So many questions. Is God dissatisfied with me? Is he upset with me? Is he punishing me? If he is, what for? How can I ask him for justice since I haven't cursed him or accused him of doing wrong? Wouldn't death be preferable to this? Now things got challenging. We could read the rest of the story. We know there were things that he did react and say that he shouldn't have. There were lessons to learn. But at that stage, what was in here? What was going through his mind? Back up a page or two in your book to the book of Esther. Example number 3 from the scripture. Esther chapter 2. Perhaps you know the backstory that Vashti, the queen, displeased her husband, Xerxes, we believe, Ahasuerus, he's called here, and things were, let's just say it wasn't a very pleasant world in general terms, especially for women at the time, especially in this kind of a situation. So she's to be replaced. She's deposed as queen. And we find we're introduced to a young woman named Hadassah, or Esther. In verse 7 of chapter 2, Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, She had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. And when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter and cared for her and raised her. Perhaps he was an older cousin. We're not told all the ins and outs of the relationship, just that she was his uncle's daughter. Never mind. You know who she was. You can read it. Uncle's daughter. So it was when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan or Susa, the citadel, this was basically a nationwide beauty contest to find a replacement queen. I don't put too fine a point on it. Like I said, not a real good time for women. Under the custody of Hegai, that Esther was taken to the king's palace into the care of Hegai, the custodian of the women. Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor, so he readily gave beauty preparations for her. Besides her allowance, 7 choice young maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, so to wait on her hand and foot. And he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. Oh, great! She has the nicest room in the harem, you know. Every day, verse 11, Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and of what was happening to her. Stop right here. Put yourself in Esther's shoes. What's she thinking? Why am I here? What has happened to me? Why did the king's agents or soldiers take me to the house of the women? Again, read harem. Even if I am in the best place in the house of the women, what good is that? Why can't I have one loving husband? Why am I surrounded by rivals for the king's affection? Why have I been taken from my home with my protective and caring cousin Mordecai? All those thoughts must have been spinning through her head. One more stop. Gospel of John, chapter 9. John, chapter 9. Verse 1. Now, as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth. He was never sighted, as we would say. Never could see. Had no idea what it was like to have the facility or the sense of sight to perceive things that for you and me are just commonplace. Perhaps you've seen someone who was gradually in a position of losing sight. My stepmother, in her later years, she died a little over a year ago at the age of 98, was struggling with macular degeneration. And the way she would describe it was when she could sort of see out of her peripheral vision, but the minute she tried to focus on something, it was gone. And it was terribly frustrating, I'm sure. Look at the question his disciples asked. This reflects the culture of the time, the world in which they lived. His disciples asked him, saying, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" I point out that verse to help us understand what it was like to live at that time in that culture. One of the things I stress in the class I teach at Foundation Institute is that quote from the British author, L.P. Hartley, "The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there." It was a different world. We wouldn't go around saying, "Huh, I wonder what awful thing this person did to be blind." We just don't think that way. But they did back there. So put yourself in this man's shoes at the time in which he lived. What could he see? Well, in his case, nothing. But what could he perceive, or what could he sense? What then would we, if we'll use a different thing, let's say, what was his frame of reference? You know, he lived in that world. How was he considering his plight? Let me put it this way. If even Jesus Christ's disciples asked him this question, what must public opinion have already concluded about this man? So what was on his mind? What questions ran through his head? Things like, why does no one have a kind word for me? How long will my family continue to support me with what little I can contribute from my begging by the side of the road? What happens if my parents disown me? How will I live then? Was I born in sin? Whose? Mine? My parents? My grandparents? The rabbis teach about to the third and fourth generation. Are all those awful things that I hear spoken about me right? Why is it that people assume if somebody doesn't see anything, they can't hear? You know, maybe you've seen a situation where someone thinks, well, if they don't speak my language, so if I just speak English louder, they'll understand me. No, it doesn't work that way. Four stories, centuries apart. No apparent connection of one of them to the other except for one simple common thread weaving through each of these four lives. The clue is in what I mentioned earlier in the sermon, connected to thoughts engendered by some whirlwind months that we've gone through recently, and which I'm sure you've all gone through similar times too. Surely you've had thoughts and times like that where you're just trying to sort it all out. You're trying to figure out, why is this happening? What am I to grab hold of here? What am I to learn? Of course, if we limit it to one lesson, if we say, what lesson am I supposed to learn? We're making a mistake. There generally are multiple lessons. But the clue is this, brethren. I referenced the holy days and their seasons earlier. The clue is God has a plan. Is that a surprise to any of us? I don't think so. Did any of these accounts and these stories, these four people in God's Word, these lives, did any of these lives happen by accident? Was there ever a time in any of them where God was not in charge? Was there a single moment that passed without His knowledge or permission for the events to happen? Well, no. They all happened for a reason. Each for a specific reason God had in mind. There is one other common thread to these four stories, and that is this. None of these people knew those specific reasons for the events in their lives at first. Not a single one. They didn't know. So let's step back for a moment and think about what I asked you to keep in mind. Remember what it was? I asked you to keep in mind the concept of focus. Where's your focus? What's it focused on? What is your frame of reference? Let me explain something and give you a comparison. You and I are at this moment whirling around the sun at roughly 66,000 miles per hour. Feel the hair blowing in your wind when you step out? How about the wind blowing in your hair? Let me get it straight. Do you feel dizzy when I say that? 66,000 miles per hour. That's the speed at which we're moving around the sun as the Earth takes its orbit. You probably don't feel dizzy. At least, no more than normal. That's because the Earth is doing the same thing. And we're on the Earth. from what we can see and experience and feel, from our frame of reference, the world we live on is stationary. Right? It's not. It's moving at 66,000 miles an hour. But from our perspective, we're still. It's the universe that's doing all the moving as far as we're concerned. The frame of reference makes all the difference in the world. It's not a phrase we use very often, but it's a concept we use nearly every day. It comes into play when we make observations like, I'm going 5 miles per hour faster than the car next to me, right? That's a frame of reference. You're both moving. Or, I'm going 15 miles per hour over the speed limit right now. Or, wow, that state trooper with a flashing light sure is gaining on me quickly. Speed requires a frame of reference. You can't just be going 75 miles per hour. You have to be going 75 miles per hour in relation to something else. Here on planet Earth, our de facto frame of reference is the surface of the planet we're on, right? I mean, we got our feet on the ground, and we're supposed to. That's why when the police officer asks us, you know, that guy who was coming up on you quickly, if we knew how fast we were going, why do they always ask that? Not that I have any great experience of being asked that question. Just a very few times, very few. The correct reply would not be faster than that other guy, or slower than you were, or 66,000 with respect to the sun. So what's another 15 at this point between you and me? You probably don't want to answer that. He's asking how fast we were going in relation to the surface of the earth. He just doesn't say the last part because it's implied, and that's good because the highway would look absolutely ridiculous if the signs all said speed limit 70 in relation to the surface of the earth. Or speed limit 66,075. Yeah, no, you know. So here's a question. Does what we see or experience or feel or our frame of reference make the speed at which the Earth is traveling around the sun irrelevant? No, it doesn't. Obviously not. All you have to do is imagine what would happen if the Earth stopped traveling at 66,000 miles per hour around the sun, and we didn't. Shoot off into space. Which makes the miracle of Joshua's long day rather interesting when you contemplate it. You'll very quickly get a sense of why that number matters a great deal. Because as long as we and the Earth keep moving at 66,000 miles per hour, we're fine. If one of them stops, we're in trouble. Our problem is that we're not really wired to keep track of multiple frames of reference. Honestly, unless you're a physics teacher or a rocket scientist, I doubt if you'd have much reason to even think about those perspectives on a regular basis. Day in, day out, our limited frame of reference, our focus, what we see, what we experience, what we look at, that persuades us that we live on a stationary planet, an Earth that remains perfectly still while the, you know, the universe slowly rolls by overhead. That's what it feels like to us. The truth of the matter is that we are on a massive, organic spaceship whirling its way around a star, nestled within a galaxy, traveling at unfathomable speeds through an ever-expanding universe. That's a little harder to wrap our minds around. But it's still true. Let's get back to our four friends from Scripture. Joseph was in that pit for a purpose. Same could be said for Job sitting on the ash heap, and for Esther in the king's harem, and for the blind man begging by the side of the road. They were all there for a purpose. But from what they could determine, from their focus, their ability to perceive, from their frame of reference, they couldn't see it, could they? For each one of them, their situation had to have looked hopeless. From our example of the earth, the universe, and that speeding ticket that you may or may not be getting, we know that all four of our biblical friends were looking at that stationary world, their world as they could see it, as they could understand it. Even though everything looked like it was standing still to them, God was moving each one of them towards something, and maybe at 66,000 miles an hour. But for them, they all still had to be asking, why me? Why is God allowing this? Doesn't He care? Has He forgotten me? Wouldn't you or I be asking those questions? I think so. But you know, the thing is, not one of those four stories stops there, does it? Those stories don't stop there. Take Joseph, for example. How long until the picture became clear for Joseph? Well, we know exactly in his case. It's documented in Scripture. We know that he was 17 when he was sold by his brothers and ended up going to Egypt to become a slave. He was sold at 17 then. He was put in prison after he was serving Potiphar when he was unjustly accused by his wife, Potiphar's wife. I wonder if Potiphar wasn't aware something was up because he didn't have him executed. He just threw him in prison. He was brought before Pharaoh at the age of 30. That's passing over a whole bunch of other incidents. Remember the butcher and the baker and when he thought he was going to be free at 28 and so on. Two more years went by. Then the seven good years went by. Now he's 37. And then 2 years of the famine passed. He's now 39 years of age. We know exactly 22 years. Turn back to Genesis 45. What was it that Joseph came to see 22 years later? Genesis 45, verse 1. Then Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, "Make everyone go out from me." So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians and the house of Pharaoh heard it. And he said to his brothers, "I am Joseph." What must that have been like? "Does my father still live?" he asked. But his brothers couldn't answer him because they were, you know, taken aback. They were just discombobulated. They were shocked. They didn't quite know what to make of it. I actually have a much better word written in my margin and I can't read it, so I have no idea what it means. Anyway, but they were pretty shocked in his presence. And Joseph said to his brothers, "Please come near to me." So they came near, and he said, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now don't be aggrieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life." God knew that. Joseph didn't have a clue at 17 or at 18, 19, 20, however old he was when he was thrown into prison, unjustly accused. Or when he was 28 and he thought his break had come with the dreams of the baker and the butcher. "For these 2 years the famine has been in the land, there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity, a remnant for you in the earth, and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it was not you who sent me here, but it was God. And He has made me a father to Pharaoh, lord of all his house, a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt." Can you see the light bulbs coming on in Joseph's mind? Can you see the awakening coming 22 2 years later. Remember, he was only 17 when he was sold. At age 39, he's lived more than half his life at this point. To that point, he lived to be 110. He had a long way to go yet, but half his life, more than half his life. God intended to establish the nation of Israel in Egypt. It says so in verse 3 of chapter 46. So he said, this is God speaking to Jacob, or Israel now, in a vision on his way to Egypt. And he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make of you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt. So that was God's purpose. His people, Israel, were to be taken to Egypt for a purpose and a plan that he had, to work out in the grand scheme of his whole plan for the human race. You see how tiny our perspective can be sometimes? And how big God's frame of reference is? My thoughts are not your thoughts doesn't even begin to describe it from our perspective, does it? Through Joseph, God saved the lives of many people, Israelite and Egyptian alike, according to chapter 50 and verse 20 of the same book of Genesis. It says, as for you, as he speaks to his brothers following his father's death, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring it about as it is this day, to save many people alive. It doesn't specify which ones. How many Egyptians lived because of Joseph? God set a very important part of his plan in motion through Joseph. It all started in a pit. The same pit where Joseph had to have wondered if God had abandoned him. Had God abandoned him? Not at all. Who gave him favor with Potiphar? Who gave him favor with the prison keeper? Who revealed the meaning of dreams to him in prison and in front of Pharaoh? Who gave him favor in Pharaoh's court? God was with him every step of the way. But Joseph couldn't see it fully for 22 years. Only when the final pieces were in place, the moving of Israel to Egypt, could he see it. But his story didn't happen by accident. What about Job? When did his life story finally make sense to him? For Job, the pieces didn't make sense until God answered out of the whirlwind. Job had lost his health, his children, nearly all of his earthly possessions. His wife's advice was, curse God and die. He was surrounded by miserable comforters, that's the phrase in Job 16 and verse 2, who were more interested in preaching at him than consoling with him. Their best time was when they sat and said nothing for 7 days after they got there. He sat on a pile of ashes using a potsherd to scrape at the sores covering his body. In his mind, there was no doubt at all that God was unjustly persecuting him. As you read through the book, that becomes very clear. He couldn't get it. He was at his lowest mental ebb, and he was prepared to face God in court and prove it. You know, that's the wording you see. And then God spoke. He answered out of the whirlwind in Job 38 and verse 2 and said, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Who's talking through his hat? Who doesn't know what in the world is going on? The next four chapters are filled with pointed questions from God, one after the other, reminding Job how little he knew and how little room he had to hurl accusations against the God of the universe, and how terribly, terribly short-sighted and destructive that would be. Even then, it's not until Job's answer that the pieces finally come together. And we know it well from the very last chapter of the book in Job 42 when he answers God and says, verse 2, I know that you can do everything and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You ask, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, I'll question you, and you shall answer me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you, and therefore I abhor myself, and I repent in dust and ashes. Job finally got the right perspective, the right frame of reference, and God allowed it. From the beginning of the book, from the moment God asked Satan, have you considered my servant Job? Chapter 1, verse 8. God had a plan, and he was putting it in motion. Satan didn't get it. He saw this as some great contest with a chance for him to pulverize one of God's great servants. But James wrote later in James 5 and verse 11, you have heard of the perseverance of Job and have seen the end intended by the Lord. Have seen the end intended. And he goes on to say that he is very compassionate and very merciful. God allowed Satan to torment Job, not because he had anything to prove to Satan. God didn't have to prove anything to Satan or Job or anybody else. He used Satan's desire for destruction to help refine Job's character so he could come to that point of saying, now my eye sees you. Job's story wasn't by accident either. What about Esther? When did she know? When did she know? Well, let's go back to the book of Esther in chapter 4. Little trivia about the book of Esther. This Esther is the only book in the Bible where the word God does not appear. And yet, his presence is all the way through it. In Esther chapter 4, her cousin Mordecai is telling her what's happening with the king and this wicked adversary Haman. So in verse 5 of Esther 4, Esther called Hatak, one of the king's eunuchs, whom he had appointed to attend her, and she gave him a command concerning Mordecai to learn what and why this was. He was in sackcloth and ashes. He was grieving. He was groaning. Chapter 4, verse 1. Bitter cry. So she said, what's going on with that? What's happening with my cousin? So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the city square in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries to destroy the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the written decree for their destruction given at Shushan or Susa, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her, and that he might command her to go into the king to make supplication to him and plead before him for her people. Remember, she had not revealed her ethnicity. He didn't know that she was a Jewess. So Hathach returned and told Esther the words of Mordecai. Then Esther spoke to him and gave him a command for Mordecai. And she said, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king who has not been called, there's but one law. Put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. Mordecai, you may be asking something of me that will take my life. So they told Mordecai Esther's words, and Mordecai told them to answer Esther. Hear Mordecai's words. Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Famous words. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Famous words. And so Esther tells Mordecai, go fast for me for 3 days, and I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. If I die, I die. So that's what happened, and you know the story, how it played out. For such a time as this, Mordecai said, Esther, this is why you are here. This is what God has been working toward. He is using you as his instrument to save your people. And apparently it really worked, because you read in chapter 8 that when the Jews were given permission to defend themselves back in that day, in that time, apparently in verses 15, 16, 17, it became very popular to be a Jew at that time. It says in verse 17 of chapter 8, in every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday, Purim. Then many of the people of the land became Jews, because fear of the Jews fell upon them. Oh, I'm a Jew. I'm with him. Can't you tell, you know, my profile? Look at that. I'm one of them. Esther's story did not happen by accident. What about the blind man? It took a miracle before his life made sense. He was blind in a culture where any misfortune of that sort was clear proof of sin. And everybody knew, you know, you weren't struck blind unless you had been a really bad sinner, or your parents or grandparents, somebody. It was a curse. Who knows how many days he sat and begged for money, seeking to lessen the burden he must have been on his family's finances. Who knows how many times he heard the derision, with people thinking, well, he can't see, he probably can't hear me either. He heard just fine. And sometimes some senses are heightened. I remember doing a whitewater rafting trip years ago at Camp Heritage, and we had a young lady in the canoe who was deaf. She could spot when we were close to a train trestle long before any of us could. She could feel the vibration in the water. Sometimes other senses are heightened. Who knows how many times he heard those thoughtless, unkind comments, the merciless reminders that he was born in sin, that his condition was a just punishment, not a tragedy. Who knows how often he struggled with those words, thought about them in the darkest corners of his heart, wondering, is it true? Is that all I am, a byproduct of sin? When the disciples saw him, they had the same question, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Who's at fault? Where do we put the blame? Jesus' response in John chapter 9 and verse 3 must have shocked anybody who heard him at the time. Because in John 9 and verse 3, he answered, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. Something's going to happen here that is going to shock the entire culture, and those who hear and see it are going to be faced with something they have no answer for. He was born for a purpose. A lifetime of blindness, culminating in one extraordinary miracle that would open the eyes of not only this man, but of many who stood watching. It was a healing that shook a community to its core. Christ didn't just restore this man's vision, he created it. He'd been born blind. As the blind man himself later professed in verse 32 when he was called upon to give account, since the world began, it has been unheard of that anyone opened the eyes of one who was born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. That whole chapter is an interesting read. He is grilled by the Pharisaical council himself, the Sanhedrin. And they ask the parents, Well, is this your son? Yes. Was he born blind? Yes. Does he now see? Apparently. Oh, how's that happen? Well, he's a grown man. Ask him. I mean, this Sanhedrin, the society of the time, the very core of existence was the synagogue that they all revolved around. To be banished from the synagogue was like a societal, cultural death sentence. Banned and banished and shunned. And basically, he ended up throwing him out of the synagogue. And he kind of played with them. He said, look, whether they said, well, this man's a sinner, or, well, I don't know whether he's a sinner or not. I know one thing. Before that, I couldn't see. After it, I could see. How hard is this? Well, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? I already explained. I don't know. Blind, see. What don't you get about that? So they reviled him and said, you're his disciple, but we're Moses' disciples. We know God spoke to Moses. We don't know where he came from. And he said, well, this is a marvelous thing. You don't know where he came from, but he opened my eyes. It's never been heard of before. So he said, if this man were not from God, he could do nothing. They said, you're born in sins. Look at that, same response. What, and you're trying to teach us? They cast him out, banished him from the synagogue. But it shook up the whole culture of the day. It revealed the Pharisaical lack of understanding to be so short-sighted. It was a witness of the power of God, by God in the flesh. His physical vision had led him to a spiritual conclusion he was willing to accept, even when it meant banishment from the synagogue, which was the core of Jewish life, first century Jewish life. When Jesus Christ revealed himself to this man as the Son of God, do you think he held any bitterness at all about the years he spent without sight? I doubt it. Instead, he fell to the ground to worship his Creator. It was clear now that every single one of those years had been spent leading up to this one priceless moment, seeing and knowing who this was. His story did not happen by accident. Guess who we're going to look at next? What's the story of your life? What kind of trials are you going through? Do all the pieces make sense to you yet? One thing we have to believe, one day they will. For some, it has been poor health. For others, challenging job situations. For others, devastated relationships. Whatever it is, when do all the pieces of our lives make sense? I can't answer that for each individual case. I don't know anyone who can. But I know someone who can. Sometimes it doesn't make sense until the end of the story. But there is always a reason. We've seen that God had his reasons in the lives of Joseph, Job, Esther, and the blind man. He has his reasons in our lives too. Today we look back on the lives of these four people in the Bible and we see it spelled out for us and we say, I see, I get it. Of course I see it now when God explains it in his word. Well, yes. And one day, we're going to look back on the difficult parts of our lives like that, and we'll say, I see. I get it now. Maybe we can't just yet. That's okay, because God can. We just don't have the right focus yet, the right frame of reference yet. We see an earth that's standing still, and God sees an earth that's flying around the sun at 66,000 miles an hour, which is hurtling around a galaxy that is rushing through an ever-expanding universe. Do you sense all of that? I don't. I never give it a second thought, except when somebody brings it up in a sermon. Kind of annoying. God knows where he wants to take you and me, and he knows why. Do we trust him? Maybe sometimes we're not always sure what kind of vessel he's making us into. Romans 9 and the analogy of the potter and the clay. Sometimes we might think we prefer to be the fancy vase and yet wonder if that's really what he's doing with us. We're not really in a position to criticize God's handiwork, are we? How can we cast doubt on what he's planning or allowing in our lives? From where we are right now, we sometimes can't see any more clearly than Joseph or Job or Esther or the blind man. But they did come to see. And so can we. James chapter 1. Here's a little bit of reassurance. James 1, verse 2. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect or mature and complete, lacking nothing. There is a reason. Even if we can't see it clearly from where we're standing in our lives right now, God has a reason for everything he allows. The path to second in command in Egypt began in a pit. The path to a deeper relationship with God began on a heap of ashes. The path to a queen who rescued a people began in an eastern harem. The path to the revelation of God's incredible power and perfect will began with blindness. When those stories began, the end was clear to no one but God. When they ended, the value of every moment along the way became obvious. We may not understand our path completely until it's over. And that's okay. We don't have to. Not right now. God does, and in the meantime, we can rest assured of one simple truth. The story of your life and mine is not happening by accident.